Disc 3.
Chapter 33. While deficit reduction was essential to my economic strategy, it was not sufficient to build a sustained, widely shared recovery. In the early months, we filled out the agenda with initiatives to expand trade, increase investment in education and training, and promote a host of microeconomic issues aimed at particular trouble spots or targets of opportunity. For example, I offered proposals to help military and civilian personnel who had lost their jobs as a result of the post-Cold War decline in defense spending, urged our major federal research labs, Los Alamos and Sandia in New Mexico, and Livermore in California, to use the massive scientific and technological resources that had helped win the Cold War to develop new technologies with commercial applications, announced a microloan program to support budding entrepreneurs, including welfare recipients eager to get off the rolls, who often had good ideas but couldn't meet the credit standards of traditional lenders, increased the volume of Small Business Administration loans, especially to women and minorities, and named a national commission to ensure a strong and competitive airline industry, chaired by former Virginia Governor Jerry Belisle. The airline manufacturers and carriers were in trouble because of the economic downturn, fewer orders for military planes, and stiff competition from the European manufacturer Airbus. I also offered plans to help communities develop commercial uses for the military facilities that would be closed as defense downsized. As governor, I had dealt with the closing of an Air Force base, and I was determined to give more aid to those facing the same challenge now. Since California was, by itself, the world's sixth largest economy, and it had been hit especially hard by defense downsizing and other problems, we developed a special plan to promote recovery there. John Emerson had the responsibility of riding herd on the project and other matters of concern to his native state. He was so unrelenting in doing so that he became known around the White House as the Secretary of California. One of the most effective things we did was to reform the regulations governing financial institutions under the 1977 Community Reinvestment Act. The law required federally insured lenders to make an extra effort to give loans to low and modest income borrowers, but before 1993, it had never had much impact. After the changes we made between 1993 and 2000, banks would offer more than $800 billion in home mortgage, small business, and community development loans to borrowers covered by the law, a staggering figure that amounted to well over 90% of all the loans made in the 23 years of the Community Reinvestment Act. May was an interesting month and valuable for my continuing political education. On the 5th, I awarded my first Presidential Medal of Freedom to my old mentor, Senator Fulbright, on his 88th birthday. Al Gore's father was at the ceremony, and when he reminded Fulbright that he himself was only 85, Fulbright replied, "Albert, if you behave yourself, you'll make it too." I admired both men for what they had done for America. I wondered if I would live as long as they had. If so, I hoped I could wear the years as well. In the third week of the month, I went to California to emphasize the investments in the economic plan for education and inner-city development at a town hall meeting in San Diego, a community college in Van Nuys with a large Hispanic enrollment, and a sporting goods store in south-central Los Angeles where the riots had occurred a year earlier. I especially enjoyed the last event. The athletic store, called the Playground, had a basketball court out back which had become a gathering place for young people. Ron Brown was with me, and we took some of the kids and played each other in an impromptu basketball game, after which I talked about the potential of empowerment zones to create more successful businesses like the Playground in poor communities all across America. I'm pretty sure this was the first time a president ever played basketball with inner-city kids in their backyard, and I hoped that pictures of the game would send a message to America about the new administration's priorities, and to young people in particular, that I cared about them and their futures. Unfortunately, most Americans never heard about the basketball game because I got a haircut. I hadn't found a barber in Washington yet. I couldn't go back to Arkansas every 3 weeks to see Jim Miles, and my hair was too long. Hillary had had her hair done by a man in Los Angeles, Christoph Schatterman, who was a friend of the Thomasons and whom I liked very much. I asked Christoph if he would be willing to give me a quick trim. He agreed to do it and met me in my private quarters on Air Force One. Before we started, I asked the Secret Service not once but twice to make sure I wouldn't cause any delay in takeoffs or landings if I put off our departure for a few minutes. They checked with the airport personnel, who said it would be no problem. Then I asked Christoph just to make me presentable as quickly as possible. He did, in 10 minutes or so, and we took off. The next thing I knew, there was a story out that I had kept two runways tied up for an hour, inconveniencing thousands of people, while I got a $200 haircut from a fancy hairdresser who was known only by his first name. Forget the basketball game with inner-city kids. The irresistible news was that I had shed my Arkansas roots and populist politics for an expensive indulgence. It was a great story, but it wasn't true. First of all, I didn't pay $200 for the 10-minute trim. Second, I didn't keep anybody waiting to take off or land, as the Federal Aviation Administration records showed when they were finally released a few weeks later. I was appalled that anyone would think I'd do such a thing. I might have been president, but Mother would still have given me a whipping if I'd kept a lot of people waiting an hour while I got a haircut, much less a $200 one. The haircut story was crazy. I didn't handle it well because I got angry, which is always a mistake. A big part of its attraction was that Christoph was a Hollywood hairdresser. Many people in Washington's political and press establishment have a love-hate relationship with Hollywood. They like to mix with movie and television stars, but tend to view the entertainment community's political interests and commitments as somehow less authentic than their own. In fact, most people in both groups are good citizens with a lot in common. Someone once said that politics is show business for ugly people. A few weeks later, Newsday, a Long Island newspaper, obtained the Federal Aviation Administration records of flight activities at the Los Angeles airport that day, proving that the reported delays had never occurred. USA Today and a few other papers also printed a correction. One thing that probably kept the haircut story alive and mostly uncorrected was something that had nothing to do with it. On May 19th, on the advice of David Watkins, who was in charge of administrative operations at the White House, and with the concurrence of the White House Counsel's office, Mac McClarty fired the 7 employees of the White House Travel Office. The office makes all arrangements for the press when they travel with the president and bills their employers for the costs. Hillary and I had both asked Mac to look into the travel office operations because she was told that the office allowed no competitive bidding on its charter flights, and I got a complaint from a White House reporter about bad meals and high costs. After an audit by the accounting firm KPMG Pete Marwick turned up an off-the-books ledger with $18,000 not properly accounted for and other irregularities, the employees were dismissed. Once I mentioned the reporter's complaint to Mac, I forgot all about the travel office until the firings were announced. The reaction of the press corps was extremely negative. They liked the way they had been cared for, especially on foreign trips, and they had known the people in the travel office for years and couldn't imagine that they would do anything wrong. Many in the press felt that the travel office staff virtually worked for them, not the White House, and felt they should have at least been notified, if not fully consulted, as the investigation proceeded. Despite the criticism, the reconstituted travel office provided the same services with fewer federal employees at lower costs to the press. The Travel Office affair proved to be a particularly powerful example of the culture clash between the new White House and the established political press. The director of the Travel Office was later indicted for embezzlement based on Travel Office funds found in his personal account, and according to press reports, he offered to plead guilty to a lesser charge and spend a few months in jail. Instead, the prosecutor insisted on going to trial on the felony charge. After several famous journalists testified for him as character witnesses, he was acquitted. Despite investigations of the Travel Office by the White House, the General Accounting Office, the FBI, and the Independent Counsel's Office, no evidence of wrongdoing, conflicts of interest, or criminality by anyone at the White House was ever found, nor did anyone dispute the Travel Office's financial problems and mismanagement found in the Pete Marwick audit. I couldn't believe the American people were seeing me primarily through the prism of the haircut, the Travel Office, and gays in the military. Instead of a president fighting to change America for the better, I was being portrayed as a man who had abandoned down home for uptown, a knee-jerk liberal whose mask of moderation had been removed. I had recently done a television interview in Cleveland in which a man said he no longer supported me because I was spending all my time on gays in the military and Bosnia. I replied that I'd just done an analysis of how I'd spent my time in the first 100 days, 55% on the economy and health care, 25% on foreign policy, 20% on other domestic issues. When he asked how much time I'd spent on gays in the military and I told him just a few hours, he simply replied, "I don't believe you." All he knew was what he read and saw. The Cleveland encounter and the haircut and Travel Office fiascos were object lessons about how little all of us outsiders knew about what mattered in Washington, and how the failure of understanding could blot out our efforts to communicate what we were doing to improve what really mattered to the rest of America. A few years later, Doug Sosnick, one of my wittiest staffers, coined a phrase that captured the buzzsaw we walked into. When we were about to leave for Oslo on a trip to promote the Middle East peace process, Sharon Farmer, my lively African-American photographer, said she wasn't looking forward to the trip to cold Norway. "That's okay, Sharon," Doug replied. "It's not a home game for you. Nobody likes the away games." Midway through 1993, I was just hoping my entire term wouldn't be one long away game. I did some serious thinking about the trouble I was in. It seemed to me that the roots of the problem were these. The White House staff had too little experience in and too few connections with Washington's established power centers. We were trying to do too many things at once, creating an impression of disarray and preventing the people from hearing what we had actually accomplished. Our lack of a clear message made otherwise minor issues look as if I was governing on the cultural and political left, not from the dynamic center, as I had promised. The impression was being reinforced by the one-note Republican attack that my budget plan was nothing but a big tax increase, and I had been blind to the considerable political obstacles I faced. I was elected by 43% of the vote. I had underestimated how hard it would be to turn Washington around after 12 years on a very different course, and how politically, even psychologically, jarring the changes would be to Washington's main players. Many Republicans never considered my presidency legitimate in the first place and were acting accordingly, and the Congress, with a Democratic majority, with its own way of doing things, and a Republican minority determined to prove I was too liberal and couldn't govern, was not about to pass all the legislation I wanted as quickly as I wanted to pass it. I knew I had to change, but just like everyone else, I found that was harder to do myself than to recommend others. Still, I managed to make two changes that were particularly helpful. I persuaded David Gergen, a friend from Renaissance Weekend and a veteran of 3 Republican administrations, to come into the White House as counselor to the president, to help us with organization and communication. In his U.S. News and World Report column, David had given some thoughtful advice, some of it quite critical, with which I agreed. He liked and respected Mac McClarty. He was a bona fide member of the Washington establishment who thought and kept score the way they did, and for the sake of the country, he wanted us to succeed. For the next several months, David had a calming impact on the White House, immediately moving to improve relations with the press by restoring their direct access to the communications office, something we should have done long before. Along with Gergen's appointment, we made some other staff changes. Mark Guerin, Mac McClarty's able and popular deputy chief of staff, would replace George Stephanopoulos as communications director, with Dee Dee Myers staying as press secretary and taking over the daily briefings. And George would move to a new senior advisor position to help me coordinate policy, strategy, and day-to-day decisions. At first, he was disappointed not to be doing the daily press briefings any longer. But he soon mastered a job much like the one he had done in the campaign, and he did it so well that his influence and impact within the White House increased. The other positive change we made was to unclutter my day, providing 2 hours in the middle of most days for me to read, think, rest, and make phone calls. It would make a big difference. Things were looking up by the end of the month when the House passed my budget, 219 to 213. The Senate then took it up and immediately scrapped the BTU tax in favor of a 4.3 cents a gallon increase in the gasoline tax and more spending cuts. The bad news was that the gas tax would promote less energy conservation than the BTU tax. The good news was that it would cost middle-class Americans less, only about $33 a year. On May 31st, my first Memorial Day as president, after the traditional ceremony in Arlington National Cemetery, I went to another ceremony at the newly opened section of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. A long black marble wall with the names of all the members of the U.S. Armed Forces who had been killed or were missing in the war etched on it. Early that morning, I had jogged over to the wall from the White House to look at the names of my friends from Hot Springs. I knelt at the spot where my friend Bert Jeffries' name was, touched it, and said a prayer. I knew it would be a tough event, full of people for whom the Vietnam War continued to be the defining moment in their lives, and to whom the thought of someone like me as Commander-in-Chief was abhorrent. But I was determined to go, to face those who still held my views on Vietnam against me, and to tell all Vietnam veterans that I honored their service and that of their fallen comrades, and would work to resolve the still open cases of prisoners of war and soldiers still listed as missing in action. Colin Powell introduced me with conviction and class, strongly signaling the respect he thought I should receive as Commander-in-Chief. Nevertheless, when I got up to speak, loud protesters attempted to drown me out. I spoke to them directly. To all of you who are shouting, "I have heard you," I ask you now to hear me. Some have suggested that it is wrong for me to be here with you today, because I did not agree a quarter of a century ago with the decision made to send the young men and women to battle in Vietnam. Well, so much the better. Just as war is freedom's cost, disagreement is freedom's privilege, and we honor it here today. The message of this memorial is quite simple. These men and women fought for freedom, brought honor to their communities, loved their country, and died for it. There's not a person in this crowd today who did not know someone on this wall. Four of my high school classmates are there. Let us continue to disagree if we must about the war, but let us not let it divide us as a people any longer. The event started roughly, but ended well. Robert McNamara's prediction that my election had ended the Vietnam War wasn't quite accurate, but maybe we were getting there. June began with a disappointment that was both personal and political, as I withdrew my nomination of Lonnie Gannier, a University of Pennsylvania professor, a longtime lawyer for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and my law school classmate, to be the first career civil rights lawyer to head the Civil Rights Division. After I named her in April, the conservatives went after Guinier with a vengeance, attacking her as a quota queen and accusing her of advocating the abandonment of the constitutional principle of one man, one vote, because she had supported a system of cumulative voting, under which each voter would get as many votes as there are contested seats on a legislative body, and could cast all the votes for a single candidate. In theory, cumulative voting would dramatically increase the odds of minority candidates being elected. At first, I didn't pay too much attention to the rantings of the right, thinking that what they really disliked about Guinier was her long record of successful civil rights fights, and that, as she made the rounds of the Senate, she would win enough votes to be confirmed easily. I was wrong. My friend Senator David Pryor came to see me and urged me to withdraw Lonnie's nomination, saying that her interviews with the senators were going poorly, and reminding me that we also had an economic program to pass and not a vote to spare. Majority Leader George Mitchell, who had been a federal judge before he came to the Senate, strongly agreed with David. He said Lonnie couldn't be confirmed, and we needed to end it as soon as possible. I was informed that Senators Ted Kennedy and Carol Moseley Brown, the Senate's only African-American member, felt the same way. I decided I had better read Lonnie's articles. They made a persuasive case for her position, but were in conflict with my support for affirmative action and opposition to quotas, and seemed to abandon one man, one vote in favor of one man, many votes, spread them out however you like. I asked her to come see me so we could talk it through. As we discussed the problem in the Oval Office, Lonnie was understandably offended by the battering she had taken, amazed that anyone would see the academic musings in her articles as a serious obstacle to her confirmation, and dismissive of the difficulties her nomination presented to the senators whose votes she needed, perhaps through several filibusters. My staff had told her we didn't have the votes to confirm her, but she declined to withdraw, feeling she had a right to be voted on. Finally, I told her that I felt I had to withdraw her nomination, that I hated to do it, but we were going to lose, and though it was cold comfort, her withdrawal would make her a heroine in the civil rights community. In the aftermath, I was heavily criticized for abandoning a friend in the face of political pressure, mostly by people who didn't know what was going on in the background. Eventually, I nominated Deval Patrick, another brilliant African-American lawyer with a strong civil rights background, to lead the Civil Rights Division, and he did a fine job. I still admire Lonnie Guinier and regret that I lost her friendship. I spent much of the first 2 weeks of June picking a Supreme Court justice. A few weeks earlier, Byron Whizzer White had announced his retirement after 31 years on the High Court. As I said earlier, I first wanted to appoint Governor Mario Cuomo, but he wasn't interested. After reviewing more than 40 candidates, I settled on three: my Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt, who had been Attorney General of Arizona before becoming governor; Judge Stephen Breyer, Chief Judge of the First Circuit Court of Appeals in Boston, who had compiled an impressive record on the bench; and Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg of the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, a brilliant woman with a compelling life story whose record was interesting, independent, and progressive. I met with Babbitt and Breyer and was convinced they both would be good justices. But I hated to lose Babbitt at Interior, as did large numbers of environmentalists who called the White House to urge that I keep him there. And Breyer had a minor nanny problem, though Senator Kennedy, who was pushing him hard, assured me that he would be confirmed. Like everything else that happened in the White House in the early months, my interviews with both men leaked. So I decided to see Ginsburg in my private office in the residence of the White House on a Sunday night. I was tremendously impressed with her. I thought she had the potential to become a great justice, and that at the least she could do three things I felt a new justice needed to do on the Rehnquist Court, which was closely divided between moderates and conservatives: decide cases on the merits, not on ideology or the identities of the parties; work with the conservative Republican justices to reach consensus when possible, and stand up to them when necessary. In one of her articles, Ginsburg had written, "The greatest figures of the American judiciary have been independent-thinking individuals with open but not empty minds, individuals willing to listen and to learn. They have exhibited a readiness to re-examine their own premises, liberal or conservative, as thoroughly as those of others." When we announced her appointment, it hadn't leaked. The press had written that I intended to appoint Breyer based on a tip from a leaker who didn't know what he was talking about. After Judge Ginsburg made her brief but moving statement, one of the reporters said her appointment gave the impression that my decision to appoint her rather than Breyer reflected a certain zigzag quality to the process of decision-making in the White House. He then asked whether I could refute that impression. I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. I replied, "I have long given up the thought that I could disabuse some of you of turning any substantive decision into anything but political process." Apparently, when it came to appointments, the name of the game wasn't supposed to be follow the leader, but follow the leaker. I have to confess that I was almost as happy about surprising the press as I was with the choice I had made. In the last week of June, the Senate finally passed my budget by only 50-49, with one Democrat and one Republican not voting, and Al Gore breaking the tie. No Republican voted for it, and we lost six conservative Democrats. Senator David Boren of Oklahoma, whom I had known since 1974 when he first ran for governor and I ran for Congress, gave us a vote to stave off defeat, but indicated that he would oppose the final bill unless it contained more spending cuts and fewer taxes. Now that the Senate and House had approved the budget plans, they would have to reconcile their differences, and then we'd have to fight for passage in both houses all over again. Since we had won by such small margins in both places, any concession made by one chamber to the other could lose a vote or two, all it would take to defeat the whole package. Roger Altman came over from Treasury with his chief of staff, Josh Steiner, to set up a war room to organize the campaign for final passage. We needed to know where every vote was and what we could argue or offer to wavering members to get a majority. After all the blood we'd spilled over minor issues, this was a fight worth making. For the next 6.5 weeks, the economic future of the country, not to mention the future of my presidency, hung in the balance. On the day after the Senate passed the budget, I ordered the military into action for the first time, firing 23 Tomahawk missiles into Iraq's intelligence headquarters in retaliation for a plot to assassinate President George H.W. Bush during a trip he had made to Kuwait. More than a dozen people involved in the plot had been arrested in Kuwait on April 13th, one day before the former president had been scheduled to arrive. The materials in their possession were conclusively traced to Iraqi intelligence, and on May 19th, one of the arrested Iraqis confirmed to the FBI that the Iraqi intelligence service was behind the plot. I asked the Pentagon to recommend a course of action, and General Powell came to me with the missile attack on the intelligence headquarters as both a proportionate response and an effective deterrent. I felt we would have been justified in hitting Iraq harder, but Powell made a persuasive case that the attack would deter further Iraqi terrorism and that dropping bombs on more targets, including presidential palaces, would have been unlikely to kill Saddam Hussein and almost certain to kill more innocent people. Most of the Tomahawks hit the target, but four of them overshot, three landing in an upscale Baghdad neighborhood and killing eight civilians. It was a stark reminder that no matter how careful the planning or how accurate the weapons, when that kind of firepower is unleashed, there are usually unintended consequences. On July 6th, I was in Tokyo for my first international meeting, the 16th annual G7 summit. Historically, these meetings had been talk fests, with few meaningful policy commitments and little follow-up coming out of them. We didn't have the luxury of another meeting where nothing happened. The world economy was dragging, with growth in Europe the slowest in more than a decade, and in Japan the slowest in nearly two decades. We were making some headway on the economic front. In the last 5 months, over 950,000 more Americans had found work, about as many new jobs as the economy had produced in the previous 3 years. I went to Japan with an agenda: to get the agreement of European and Japanese leaders to coordinate their internal economic policies with ours in order to raise the level of global growth, convince Europe and Japan to drop tariffs on manufacturing goods, which would create jobs in all our countries and increase the chances of finishing the 7-year-old Uruguay round of world trade talks by the December 15th deadline, and send a clear, unified signal of financial and political support for Yeltsin and Russian democracy. The odds of success on any of these items, much less all three, were not great, in part because none of the leaders were particularly strong coming into the meeting. Between the tough medicine in my economic plan and the bad press over problems, both real and imagined, my public approval had dropped steeply since the inauguration. John Major was hanging on in England, but was hurt by constant unfavorable comparison to his predecessor, Margaret Thatcher, something the Iron Lady did nothing to discourage. François Mitterrand was a fascinating, brilliant man, a socialist in his second 7-year term, who was limited in what he could deliver by the fact that the French prime minister and his governing coalition, who controlled economic policy, were from opposing political parties. Carlo Ciampi, the Italian prime minister, was a former governor of the Italian Central Bank and a modest man who was known for riding his bicycle to work. Despite his intelligence and appeal, he was hampered by the fractured and inherently unstable Italian political environment. Kim Campbell, Canada's first female prime minister, was an impressive, clearly dedicated person who had just taken office after the resignation of Brian Mulroney. She was essentially finishing Mulroney's long run at the helm, with the polls showing a rising tide of support for the opposition leader, Jean Chrétien. Our host, Keiichi Miyazawa, was widely regarded as a lame duck in a Japanese political system in which the long monopoly of the Liberal Democratic Party was coming to an end. Miyazawa may have been a lame duck, but he was an impressive one, with sophisticated understanding of the world. He spoke colloquial English about as well as I did, and he was also a patriot who wanted the G7 meeting to reflect well on his country. The conventional wisdom held that Helmut Kohl, the long-serving German chancellor, was also in trouble, because his poll numbers were down and his Christian Democratic Party had suffered some recent losses in local elections. But I thought Kohl still had plenty of life in his leadership. He was a huge man, about my height and weighing well over 300 pounds. He spoke with great conviction in a direct, often brusque manner, and he was a world-class storyteller with a good sense of humor. And in more than size, he was the largest figure on the European continent in decades. He had reunified Germany, funneling massive sums of money from West to East Germany to lift the incomes of those who had made far less under communism. Kohl's Germany had become the largest financial supporter of Russian democracy. He was also the leading force behind the emerging European Union, and he was in favor of admitting Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic into both the EU and the NATO alliance. Finally, Kohl was deeply troubled by Europe's passivity in Bosnia and thought, as I did, that the United Nations should lift the arms embargo because it was unfair to the Bosnian Muslims. On all the great questions facing Europe, he was on the right side and pushing hard for his point of view. He felt if he got the big things right, the Poles would follow. I liked Helmut Kohl a lot. Over the next several years, through many meals, visits, and phone calls, we would forge a political and personal bond that would bear great fruit for Europeans and Americans alike. I was optimistic about the prospects of the G7 because I was bringing a strong agenda to the meeting and because I believed the other leaders were smart enough to know that the best way to get out of trouble at home was to do something meaningful in Tokyo. Just as the conference opened, we crossed one threshold when our trade ministers agreed that all of us would lower tariffs to zero on 10 different manufacturing sectors, opening markets for hundreds of billions of dollars worth of trade. It was Mickey Cantor's first victory as our trade ambassador. He had proved to be a tough, effective negotiator with skills that eventually would produce more than 200 agreements, sparking an expansion of trade that would account for almost 30% of our economic growth over the next 8 years. After we agreed on a generous aid package, the G7 meeting also left no doubt that the rich nations were all committed to helping Russia. On the matter of coordinating our economic policies, the results were more ambiguous. I was working to bring the deficit down, and Germany's central bank had just lowered interest rates, but Japan's willingness to stimulate its economy and open its borders to more foreign trade and competition remained unclear. That was progress I'd have to achieve in our bilateral talks with the Japanese, which began right after the G7 meeting. In 1993, because Japan was dealing with economic stagnation and political uncertainty, I knew it would be hard to get changes in trade policy, but I had to try. Clearly, our large trade deficit with Japan was due in part to protectionism. For example, they wouldn't buy our skis, saying they weren't the right width. I had to find a way to push open Japanese markets without damaging our important security partnership, which was essential to building a stable future for Asia. While I was making these points in a speech to Japanese students at Waseda University, Hillary went on her own charm offensive in Japan, finding an especially warm reception among the increasingly large number of young, well-educated working women. Prime Minister Miyazawa agreed in principle to my suggestion that we achieve a framework agreement committing ourselves to specific, measurable steps to improve our trade relationship. So did the Japanese Foreign Ministry, whose senior civil servant, the father of Japan's new crown princess, was determined to reach an agreement. The big obstacle was the Ministry of International Trade and Industry, MITI. Whose leaders felt that their policies had made Japan a great power and saw no reason to change. Late one night after we finished our talks, representatives of the two ministries were literally screaming their arguments at each other in the lobby of the Hotel Akura. Our staffs got as close as they could to an agreement, with Mickey Cantor's deputy, Charlene Barshefsky, driving such a hard bargain the Japanese called her Stonewall. Then Miyazawa and I got together over a traditional Japanese meal at the Hotel Akura to see if we could resolve the remaining differences. We did in what was later called the Sushi Summit, though Miyazawa always joked that the sake we drank contributed more than the sushi to our final outcome. The framework agreement committed America to reduce its budget deficit and Japan to take steps over the next year to open its markets in automobile and auto parts, computers, telecommunications, satellites, medical equipment, financial services, and insurance, with objective standards for measuring success on specific timetables. I was convinced that the agreement would be economically beneficial to both the United States and Japan, and that it would help Japanese reformers succeed in leading their remarkable nation to its next era of greatness. Like most such agreements, it didn't produce all one could hope for in either country, but it was still a very good thing. As I left Japan for Korea, the press reports back home said that my first G7 meeting was a triumph for my personal diplomacy with the other leaders and my outreach to the Japanese people. It was nice to get some positive press coverage, and even better, to have met the objectives we set for the G7 and the Japanese negotiations. I had enjoyed getting to know and work with the other leaders, and after the G7, I felt more confident in my ability to advance America's interests in the world and understood why so many presidents preferred foreign policy to the frustrations they faced on the home front. In South Korea, I visited our troops along the DMZ, which had divided North and South Korea since the armistice ending the Korean War was signed. I walked out onto the Bridge of No Return, stopping about 10 feet from the stripe of white paint dividing the two countries and staring at the young North Korean soldier guarding his side in the last lonely outpost of the Cold War. In Seoul, Hillary and I were the guests of President Kim Yong-sam in the official guest residence, which had an indoor swimming pool. When I went for a dip, music suddenly filled the air. I found myself swimming to many of my favorite tunes, from Elvis to jazz, a nice example of Korea's famous hospitality. After a meeting with the president and a speech to the parliament, I left South Korea grateful for our long alliance and determined to maintain it. Chapter 34. I returned to the rigors of Washington. In the third week of July, on the recommendation of Janet Reno, I dismissed the director of the FBI, William Sessions, after he refused to resign despite numerous problems within the agency. We had to find a replacement. Bernie Nussbaum urged me to choose Louis Free, a former FBI agent whom President Bush had appointed to the federal bench in New York after a stellar career as a federal prosecutor. When I met with Free, I asked him what he thought about the FBI's assertion at Waco that they had proceeded with the raid because it was wrong to keep so many of their resources tied down in one place for so long. Without knowing what I thought, he said forthrightly that he disagreed. They get paid to wait. That impressed me. I knew Free was a Republican, but Nussbaum assured me that he was a professional and a stand-up guy who would not use the FBI for political purposes. We scheduled the announcement for the 20th. The day before, when word got out about the appointment, a retired FBI agent who was a friend of mine called Nancy Heinrich, who ran the Oval Office operations, to tell me not to do it. He said Free was too political and self-serving for the current climate. It gave me pause, but I sent word back that it was too late. The offer had been extended and accepted. I would just have to trust Bernie Nussbaum's judgment. When we announced Free's appointment in a morning ceremony in the Rose Garden, I noticed Vince Foster standing at the back, near one of the grand old magnolia trees planted by Andrew Jackson. Vince had a smile on his face, and I remember thinking he must be relieved that he and the counsel's office were working on things like Supreme Court and FBI appointments instead of answering endless questions about the travel office. The whole ceremony seemed perfect, almost too good to be true. It was, in more ways than one. That night I appeared on Larry King's show from the library on the ground floor of the White House to talk about my battle for the budget and whatever else was on his and his callers' minds. Like everyone else, I liked Larry King. He has a good sense of humor and a human touch, even when he's asking tough questions. About 45 minutes into the program, things were going so well that Larry asked me if I'd do an extra 30 minutes so that we could take more questions from viewers. I agreed immediately and was looking forward to it. But at the next break, Mac McClarty showed up and said we had to end the interview after an hour. At first, I was irritated, thinking my staff was worried that I might make a mistake if I kept going. But the look in Mac's eyes told me something else was going on. After Larry and I wrapped up the interview and I shook hands with his crew, Mac walked me upstairs to the residence. Holding back tears, he told me Vince Foster was dead. Vince had left the Rose Garden after the ceremony for Louis Free, driven out to Fort Marcy Park, and shot himself with an old revolver that was a family heirloom. We had been friends virtually all our lives. Our backyards had touched when I lived with my grandparents in Hope. We had played together even before Mac and I started kindergarten. I knew Vince had been upset by the travel office controversy and held himself responsible for the criticism directed at the council's office. He had also been wounded by questions raised about his competence and integrity in several Wall Street Journal editorials. Just the night before, I had called Vince to invite him to watch a movie with me. I was hoping to give him some encouragement, but he had already gone home for the night and said he needed to spend some time with his wife, Lisa. I did my best in our phone conversation to persuade him to shrug off the Journal editorials. The Journal was a fine paper, but not that many people read its editorials. Most of those who did were, like the editorial writers, conservatives who were lost to us anyway. Vince listened, but I could tell I hadn't convinced him. He had never been subject to public criticism before, and like so many people when they're pounded in the press for the first time, he seemed to think that everyone had read the negative things said about him and believed them. After Mac told me what had happened, Hillary called me from Little Rock. She already knew and was crying. Vince had been her closest friend at the Rose Firm. She was frantically searching for an answer we would never completely find. Why this had happened? I did my best to convince her there was nothing she could have done, all the while wondering what I could have done. Then Mac and I went over to Vince's house to be with the family. Webb and Susie Hubble were there, as were several of Vince's friends from Arkansas and the White House. I tried to console everyone, but I was hurting too, and feeling as I had when Frank Aller killed himself, angry at Vince for doing it, and angry at myself for not seeing it coming, and doing something, anything, to try to stop it. I was also sad for all my friends from Arkansas who had come to Washington wanting nothing more than to serve and do good, only to find their every move second-guessed. Now Vince, the tall, handsome, strong, and self-assured person they felt was the most stable of them all, was gone. For whatever reason, Vince came to the end of his rope. In his briefcase, Bernie Nussbaum found a note that had been torn into little pieces. When put back together, it said, "I was not meant for the job in the spotlight of public life in Washington. Here, ruining people is considered sport. The public will never believe the innocence of the Clintons and their loyal staff." Vince was overwhelmed, exhausted, and vulnerable to attacks by people who didn't play by the same rules he did. He was rooted in the values of honor and respect, and uprooted by those who valued power and personal assault more. And his untreated depression stripped him of the defenses that allowed the rest of us to survive. The next day I spoke to the staff, telling them that there are things in life we can't control and mysteries we can't understand, that I wanted them to take more care with themselves, their friends, and their families, and that we couldn't deaden our sensitivities by working too hard. That last bit of advice had always been easier for me to give than to take. We all went to Little Rock for Vince's funeral at St. Andrew's Catholic Cathedral, then drove home to Hope to lay Vince to rest in the cemetery where my grandparents and father were buried. Many people with whom we'd gone to kindergarten and grade school were there. By then, I had given up trying to understand Vince's depression and suicide in favor of accepting them and being grateful for his life. In my eulogy at the funeral, I tried to capture all of Vince's wonderful qualities, what he meant to all of us, how much good he had done at the White House, and how profoundly honorable he was. I quoted from Leon Russell's moving A Song for You, "I love you in a place where there's no space or time. I love you, for in my life you are a friend of mine." It was summertime and the watermelon crop had begun to come in. Before I left town, I stopped at Carter Russell's place and sampled both the red and yellow-meated ones. Then I discussed the finer points of Hope's main product with the traveling press, who knew I needed a respite from the pain and were uncommonly kind to me that day. I flew back to Washington thinking Vince was home, where he belonged, and thanking God that so many people cared about him. The next day, July 24th, I welcomed the current class of American Legion Boys Nation senators to the White House on the 30th anniversary of my coming to the Rose Garden to meet President Kennedy. A number of my fellow delegates were also there for the reunion. Al Gore was lobbying hard for our economic plan, but he broke away for a couple of minutes to tell the boys, "I have only one word of advice. If you can manage somehow to get a picture of you shaking hands with President Clinton, it might come in handy later on." I shook hands and posed for pictures with all of them, as I would do in 6 of my 8 years in the White House, for both Boys and Girls Nation. I hope some of those photos turn up in campaign ads one day. I spent the rest of the month and the early days of August lobbying individual representatives and senators on the economic plan. Roger Altman's war room was working the public side, having me do telephone and press conferences in states whose members of Congress could go either way. Al Gore and the cabinet were making literally hundreds of calls and visits. The outcome was uncertain and tilting away from us for two reasons. The first was Senator David Boren's proposal to scrap any energy tax, keep most but not all of the taxes on the high-income Americans, and make up the difference by eliminating much of the earned income tax credit, reduce the cost of living adjustments for Social Security and military and civilian pensions, and cap expenditures for Medicare and Medicaid below the projected requirements for new recipients and cost increases. Boren couldn't pass his proposal out of committee, but he gave Democrats from conservative states a place to go. It was also endorsed by Democratic Senator Bennett Johnston of Louisiana and Republican Senators John Danforth of Missouri and Bill Cohen of Maine. When the budget had first passed 50-49 with Al Gore breaking the tie, Bennett Johnston had voted against it, along with Sam Nunn, Dennis DeConcini of Arizona, Richard Shelby of Alabama, Richard Bryan of Nevada, and Frank Lautenberg of New Jersey. Shelby was already drifting toward the Republican Party in an increasingly Republican state. Sam Nunn was a hard no. DeConcini, Bryan, and Lautenberg were worried about the anti-tax mood in their states. As I've said, I had made it the first time without them because two senators, one Republican and one Democrat, didn't vote. The next time, they would all show up. With all the Republicans against us, if Boren voted no and none of the others changed, I would lose 51-49. Besides those 6, Senator Bob Kerry was also saying he might vote against the program. Our relationship had been strained by the presidential campaign, and Nebraska was a heavily Republican state. Still, I was optimistic about Kerry because he was genuinely committed to reducing the deficit, and he was very close to the Senate Finance Committee Chairman, Pat Moynihan, who was strongly supporting my plan. In the House of Representatives, I had a different problem. Every Democrat knew he or she had maximum leverage, and many were bargaining with me over details of the plan or for help on specific issues. Many of the Democrats who came from anti-tax districts were especially afraid of voting for another increase in the gas tax only 3 years after Congress had last raised it. Besides the Speaker and his leadership team, my strongest supporter was the powerful chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Illinois Congressman Dan Rostenkowski. Rostenkowski was a superb legislator who combined a fine mind with Chicago street skills, but he was being investigated for converting public funds to political uses, and the assumption was that the investigation would reduce his influence over other members. Every time I met with members of Congress, the press would ask me about Rostenkowski. To his everlasting credit, Rosty bulled right ahead, rounding up votes and telling his colleagues they had to do the right thing. He was still effective, and he had to be. The slightest misstep could lose a vote or two, plunging us off the razor's edge into defeat. In early August, as the budget drama moved to its climax, Warren Christopher finally secured the agreement of the British and the French to conduct NATO airstrikes in Bosnia, but the strikes could occur only if both NATO and the UN approved them, the so-called dual-key approach. I was afraid we could never turn both keys, because Russia had a veto on the Security Council and was closely tied to the Serbs. The dual key would prove to be a frustrating impediment to protecting the Bosnians, but it marked another step in the long, torturous process of moving Europe and the UN to a more aggressive posture. By August 3rd, we had settled on a final budget plan, with $255 billion in budget cuts and $241 billion in tax increases. Some Democrats were still worried that any gas tax increase would kill us with those middle-class voters who were angry anyway about not getting a tax cut. Conservative Democrats said it didn't do enough to reduce the deficit through cutting spending on the entitlements of Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. More than 20% of our savings already came from reducing future payments to doctors and hospitals under Medicare, plus another big chunk from subjecting more of the Social Security income of better-off retirees to taxation. That's all I could do without losing more votes in the House than we could gain. That night, in a televised address from the Oval Office, I made one last pitch for public support for the plan, saying it would create 8 million jobs in the next 4 years, and announcing that I would sign an executive order the following day to establish a deficit reduction trust fund, assuring that all the new taxes and spending cuts would be used for that purpose only. The trust fund was especially important to Senator Dennis DeConcini of Arizona, and I credited him for the idea in the TV address. Of the 6 senators who had voted against the plan the first time, DeConcini was my only hope. I had had the others to dinner, met with and called them, and had their closest friends in the administration lobby them, to no avail. If DeConcini didn't change, we were beat. The next day, he did, saying he would vote yes because of the trust fund. Now, if Bob Kerry stayed with us, we would get 50 votes in the Senate, and Al Gore could break the tie again. But before we got there, the budget first had to pass the House. We had one more day to find a majority of 218 votes, and we still weren't there. More than 30 Democrats were wavering. They were afraid of the taxes, though we had done printouts for each of the members showing how many people in their districts would get a tax cut under the EITC, as compared with those who would get an income tax increase. In many cases, the ratio was 10-1 or better, and in barely more than a dozen were their constituents so well off that the district would see more tax increases than decreases. Still, they were all worried about the gas tax. I could have passed the plan easily had I dropped the gas tax and offset the loss by abandoning the EITC tax cut. It would have been far less politically damaging. Poor working people had no lobbyists in Washington. They would never have known, but I would have. Besides, if we were going to soak the rich, the bond market wanted us to spray the middle class with a little bit of pain. That afternoon, Leon Panetta and House Majority Leader Dick Gephardt, who was working tirelessly for the budget, had struck a deal with Congressman Tim Penny of Minnesota, the leader of a group of conservative Democrats who wanted more spending cuts, promising the budget cutters another vote during the fall appropriations process to cut spending even more. Penny was satisfied, and his approval brought us 7 or 8 more votes. We lost 2 of our earlier yes votes when Billy Tozan of Louisiana, who later became a Republican, and Charlie Stenholm of Texas, who represented a district where more of the voters were Republican, said they would vote no. They hated the gas tax and said the unified Republican opposition to the plan had convinced their constituents that it was nothing but a tax increase. Less than an hour before the vote, I spoke with Congressman Bill Sarpalias from Amarillo, Texas, who had voted against the plan in May. In our 4th phone conversation of the day, Bill said he had decided to vote for the plan, because so many more of his constituents would get tax cuts than tax increases, and because Energy Secretary Hazel O'Leary had pledged to shift more government work to the Pantex plant in his district. We made many commitments like that. Someone once said that the two things people should never watch being made are sausages and laws. It was ugly and uncertain. When the voting began, I still didn't know whether we were going to win or lose. After David Minge, who represented a rural district in Minnesota, said he would vote no, it all came down to three people: Pat Williams of Montana, Ray Thornton of Arkansas, and Marjorie Margolis-Mezvinsky of Pennsylvania. I really didn't want Margolis-Mezvinsky to have to vote with us. She was one of the very few Democrats who represented a district with more constituents who would get tax hikes than tax cuts, and in her campaign she had promised not to vote for any tax increases. It was a tough vote for Pat Williams, too. Far more of his constituents would get tax cuts than tax increases, but Montana was a huge, sparsely populated state where people had to drive long distances, so the gas tax would hit them harder than most Americans. But Pat Williams was a good politician and a tough populist who deplored what trickle-down economics had done to his people. There was at least a chance that he could survive the vote. Compared with Williams and Margolis-Mezvinsky, Thornton had an easy vote. He represented central Arkansas, where there were far more people who would get a tax cut than a tax increase. He was popular and could not have been blown out of his seat with a stick of dynamite. He was my congressman, and my presidency was on the line. And he had lots of cover. Both Arkansas Senators David Pryor and Dale Bumpers were strong supporters of the plan. But in the end, Thornton said no. He had never voted for a gas tax before, and he wouldn't start now. Not to get the deficit down, not to revive the economy, not to save my presidency or the career of Marjorie Margolis-Mezvinsky. Finally, Pat Williams and Margolis-Mezvinsky came down the aisle and voted yes, giving us a one-vote victory. The Democrats cheered their courage, and the Republicans jeered. They were especially cruel to Margolis-Mezvinsky, waving and singing, "Goodbye, Margie." She had earned an honored place in history with a vote she shouldn't have had to cast. Dan Rostenkowski was so happy he had tears in his eyes. Back in the White House, I let out a whoop of joy and relief. The next day, the drama moved to the Senate. Thanks to George Mitchell and his leadership team and our lobbying, we had held all the senators from the first vote except David Boren. Dennis DeConcini had bravely stepped into his place, but the outcome was still in doubt because Bob Kerry remained uncommitted. On Friday, he met with me for 90 minutes, then about an hour and a half before the vote, he spoke on the Senate floor saying directly to me, "I could not and should not cast a vote that brings down your presidency." While he would vote yes, he said I would have to do more to control entitlement spending. I agreed to work with him on this. He was pleased with that, as well as with my acceptance of Tim Penny's proposal for an October vote on more cuts. Kerry's vote made it a 50-50 tie. Then, just as he had in the first vote on June 25th, Al Gore, as president of the Senate, cast the tie-breaking vote. In a statement after the vote, I thanked George Mitchell and all the senators who voted for change, and Al Gore for his unwavering contribution in the landslide. Al loved to joke that whenever he voted, we always won. I signed the legislation on August 10th. It reversed 12 years in which the national debt had quadrupled, with deficits built on overly optimistic revenue numbers and an almost theological belief that low taxes and high levels of spending would somehow bring enough growth to balance the budget. At the ceremony, I specifically acknowledged those senators and representatives whose support never wavered from beginning to end, and who therefore were never mentioned in the news stories. Every yes voter in both houses of the Congress could rightfully say that but for him or her, we would not be here today. We had come a long way since those heated debates around the dining room table in Little Rock the previous December. All by themselves, the Democrats had replaced a wrong-headed but deeply embedded economic theory with a sensible one. Our new economic idea had become reality. Unfortunately, the Republicans, whose policies had created the problem in the first place, had done a good job portraying the plan as nothing but a tax increase. It was true that most of the spending cuts kicked in later than the tax increases, but that was also true of the alternative budget offered by Senator Dole. In fact, Dole's plan had an even higher percentage of its cuts in the last 2 years of the five-year budget than mine did. It simply takes time to reduce defense and health spending. You can't slash it all at once. Moreover, our future investments in education, training, research, technology, and the environment were already at unacceptably low levels, having been held down in the 80s as tax cuts, defense appropriations, and health costs soared. My budget began to reverse that trend. Predictably, the Republicans said my economic plan would cause the sky to fall in, calling it a job killer and a one-way ticket to recession. They were wrong. Our bond market gambit would work beyond our wildest dreams, bringing lower interest rates, a soaring stock market, and a booming economy. Just as Lloyd Vinson had predicted, the wealthiest Americans would get their tax money back and more in investment income. The middle class would get their gas tax money back many times over, in lower home mortgage rates and lower interest costs for car payments, student loans, and credit card purchases. Working families with modest incomes benefited from the earned income tax credit right away. In later years, I was often asked what great new idea my economic team and I brought to economic policymaking. Rather than give a complicated explanation of the bond market deficit reduction strategy, I always gave a one-word answer: arithmetic. The American people had been told for more than a decade that their government was a gluttonous leviathan swallowing their hard-earned tax dollars to no good end. Then the same politicians who told them that and served up tax cuts to starve the evil beast would turn right around and spend themselves to re-election, leaving the false impression that the voters could have programs they didn't pay for, and that the only reason we had big deficits was wasteful spending on foreign aid, welfare, and other programs for poor people, a tiny fraction of the budget. Spending on them was bad. Spending and tax cuts for us were good. As my fiscally conservative friend Senator Dale Bumpers used to say, "You let me write $200 billion a year in hot checks, and I'll show you a good time, too." We had brought arithmetic back to the budget and broken America of a bad habit. Unfortunately, though the benefits began to accrue right away, the people wouldn't feel them for some time. In the meantime, my fellow Democrats and I bore the brunt of the public's withdrawal pains. I couldn't expect gratitude. Even with an abscessed tooth, nobody likes to go to the dentist. Chapter 35. After the budget passed, Congress went on its August recess, and I was eager to take my family on vacation for 2 much-needed weeks on Martha's Vineyard. Vernon and Ann Jordan had arranged for us to stay on the edge of Oyster Pond in a cottage that belonged to Robert McNamara. But before I could leave, there was a busy week of work. On the 11th, I nominated Army General John Shalikashvili to succeed Colin Powell as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff when Colin's term ended in late September. Shali, as everyone called him, had entered the Army as a draftee and risen through the ranks to his current position as the commander of NATO and U.S. forces in Europe. He was born in Poland to a family from Georgia in the former Soviet Union. Before the Russian Revolution, his grandfather had been a general in the Tsar's army, and his father had been an officer, too. When Shali was 16, his family moved to Peoria, Illinois, where he taught himself English by watching John Wayne movies. I thought he was the right man to lead our forces in the post-Cold War world, especially given all the problems in Bosnia. In mid-month, Hillary and I flew to St. Louis, where I signed the Mississippi River flood relief legislation after an enormous flood had caused the upper Mississippi River to overrun its banks all the way from Minnesota and the Dakotas down to Missouri. The bill signing ceremony marked my third visit to the flooded areas. Farms and businesses had been destroyed, and some small towns within the 100-year floodplain had been completely wiped out. On every trip, I marveled at the number of citizens from all over America who just showed up to help. Then we flew on to Denver, where we welcomed Pope John Paul II to the United States. I had a productive meeting with His Holiness, who supported our mission in Somalia and my desire to do more in Bosnia. After we finished, he graciously received all the Catholics on the White House staff and on my Secret Service detail who had been able to come to Denver with me. The next day, I signed the Colorado Wilderness Act, my first major environmental legislation, protecting more than 600,000 acres of national forests and public lands in the National Wilderness Preservation System. Then I went on to Tulsa, Oklahoma, to speak to my old colleagues at the National Governors Association about health care. Though the ink was barely dry on the budget plan, I wanted to get started on health care and thought the governors might help, because the rising cost of Medicaid, state employees' health insurance, and the health care of the uninsured were a big burden on state budgets. On the 19th, my 47th birthday, I announced that Bill Daley of Chicago would become the chair of our task force on the North American Free Trade Agreement. 6 days earlier, with Canada and Mexico, we had completed the side deals to NAFTA on labor and environmental rights, which I had promised in the campaign, as well as one protecting our markets from import surges. Now that they were in place, I was ready to go all out to pass NAFTA in the Congress. I thought Bill Daley was the ideal person to head the campaign for it. He was a Democratic lawyer from Chicago's most famous political family. His brother was the city's mayor, as his father had been before him, and he had good relationships with several labor leaders. NAFTA would be a very different fight from the budget. A lot of Republicans would support it, and we had to find enough Democrats to go along over the objections of the AFL-CIO. After the Daley announcement, we flew off to Martha's Vineyard. That night, the Jordans hosted a birthday party for me, with old friends and some new ones. Jackie Kennedy Onassis and her companion Maurice Templesman came, along with Bill and Rose Styron, and Catherine Graham, the publisher of the Washington Post and one of the people I most admired in Washington. The next day we went sailing and swimming with Jackie and Maurice, Ann and Vernon, Ted and Vicky Kennedy, and Ed and Caroline Kennedy Schlossberg. Caroline and Chelsea climbed up on a high platform of Maurice's yacht and jumped into the water. They dared Hillary to follow suit, and Ted and I urged her on. Only Jackie encouraged her to take a safer route to the water. With her usual good judgment, Hillary listened to Jackie. I spent the next 10 days hanging around Oyster Pond, catching crabs with Hillary and Chelsea, walking on the beach that bordered the pond and the Atlantic Ocean, getting to know some of the people who lived in the area year-round, and reading.
End of Disc 3.